the Great Mothers.
I'm Frieda Worden. Thanks for listening. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! Human Rights Watch is accusing Israel of committing acts of extermination and genocide by intentionally depriving Palestinians in Gaza of water. We'll speak with the group's Israel-Palestine Associate Director. Then to Syria, where mass graves are being uncovered following the toppling of the Assad regime.
We established that these summary executions took place in the Tadalmon area of Damascus on April 16, 2013. Since the fall of the Assad government, we have been able to travel to Damascus to see the area for ourselves.
And in California, the federal government will pay a record $116 million to more than 100 women who were sexually abused in a federal prison in Dublin, California.
The reason we're seeing historic, unprecedented lawsuits winning against the federal prison system is because the issue of staff sexual abuse is rampant across not just the federal prison system, but every type of carceral facility across the country. And when survivors speak up and link up with advocates on the outside, we're seeing that historic wins are possible.
We'll speak to an organizer with the California Coalition for Women Prisoners and one of the former prisoners at Dublin who's a plaintiff in the case. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fresh Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip have killed at least 25 Palestinians, including children. That includes 16 people killed in Jabalia in northern Gaza, a strike on Maghazi refugee camp that killed four, and bombings in Gaza City that killed at least five others. Survivors scrambled to retrieve people from under the rubble.
At exactly 10:02 at night, we were sleeping. Suddenly, we heard the sounds of a strike. How, we don't know. We went down and found it was our neighbor's house, the Zaytunia family. We pulled out several martyrs, children and women, and until now, there are still people under the rubble they cannot reach. As you can see, they're pulling them out. They're digging with their hands.
Among the recent victims of Israel's bombardment of Gaza were twin sisters Sally and Dalia Ghazi Ibayi. The 26-year-olds had recently been accepted to attend the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, as part of the Global Student Relief Initiative, which supports students from conflict zones. They were killed by an Israeli bombing on December 5th as they attempted to leave Gaza via the Rafah border crossing into Egypt. A new report in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz finds Israel's military's designated the Netzarim corridor, which cuts the Gaza Strip in half, as a kill zone. The report quotes Israeli soldiers describing how they arbitrarily killed dozens of Palestinian civilians, including children, then posthumously declared them to be terrorists. Separately, Human Rights Watch warns in a new report that since October 2023, Israeli authorities have deliberately obstructed Palestinians' access to the adequate amount of water required for survival in the Gaza Strip, an act tantamount to genocide. Meanwhile, Israel killed at least nine people in overnight bombing raids on port infrastructure and oil storage facilities near Yemen's capital, Sana'a. The bombings came after Israel's military said it had intercepted a missile launched by Yemen's Houthis before it crossed into Israeli territory. The U.S. Senate has approved a record $895 billion military spending package on a bipartisan vote of 85-14, sending the bill to President Biden for his signature. Congress approved this year's National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, even after the Pentagon failed its seventh consecutive audit, with Pentagon officials unable to fully account for trillions of dollars. An amendment to the NDAA strips away service members' members' parental rights to access gender-affirming health care for transgender children. That prompted calls from the ACLU and other civil rights groups for President Biden to veto the legislation. The bill also includes more than $500 million in additional military aid to Israel. Republican lawmakers have rejected House Speaker Mike Johnson's plan to avert a government shutdown after President-elect Trump condemned the deal and Elon Musk threatened to end the political careers of Republicans who support it. Unless Congress approves new spending by midnight Friday, most federal agencies will shut down non-essential operations. Johnson's compromise plan included more than $100 billion in disaster aid to states hard hit by hurricanes Helene and Milton and other natural disasters. It also included $30 billion in economic assistance to farmers. Politico reports the Republican House Speaker Johnson is now considering passing a so-called clean funding package that excludes farm relief and disaster aid. Johnson's reversal came after Elon Musk, the world's richest person, wrote on his social media site X, quote, "Any member of the House or Senate who votes for this outrageous spending bill deserves to be voted out in 2 years." Responding to Musk, Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders wrote, quote, "Billionaires must not be allowed to run our government." House Republicans have introduced the DOGE Act, a bill to cut federal spending by $114 billion. The bill would slash programs for climate, education, energy, healthcare, transportation, veterans care, and more. However, it would not reduce Pentagon spending. On Tuesday, Republicans convened the first meeting of the Delivering Outstanding Government Efficiency Caucus, or DOGE. The new caucus's name is a nod to the Department of Government Efficiency, an advisory commission led by the unelected billionaires Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. It's also a reference to a meme coin cryptocurrency promoted by Musk. At least one Republican lawmaker, Greg Lopez of Colorado, said at the DOGE caucus meeting he expects cuts to Social Security and Medicare despite Trump's campaign pledge to leave the programs alone.
Sir, can we get a pledge to stand with President Trump against cuts to Social Security and Medicare benefits?
I think, you know what, when we look to reduce our national debt, I think these should be on the table.
Okay.
You know, so I am a strong advocate of discussing this and reevaluating them. And I do believe at the end of the day, there will be some cuts.
There are cuts to Social Security and Medicare?
Yes.
The House Ethics Committee has reportedly voted to release its report on former Congressmember Matt Gaetz, including his sex trafficking of underage girls. The report could be made public as soon as this week after lawmakers cast their final votes of the 118th Congress. The firestorm around the report and the accusations led to Gaetz withdrawing from consideration to be attorney general under the incoming Trump administration. Meanwhile, Trump has tapped failed U.S. Senate candidate Herschel Walker to become ambassador to the Bahamas. Walker, who lost his 2022 Georgia Senate race to Raphael Warnock, has been accused of violence by his ex-wife, as well as pressuring at least two partners to have abortions, even though his public stance is ardently anti-abortion. In a case that's galvanized France, a court has found the ex-husband of a French woman, Gisèle Pelicot, guilty on all charges for repeatedly raping his wife and inviting dozens of other men to rape her after he drugged her unconscious. A panel of judges sentenced Dominique Pelicot to the maximum 20 years in prison. 50 other men who also raped or sexually assaulted Gisèle Pelicot with her husband's help were also found guilty. The shocking case has made headlines around the world, and the 3.5-month trial gripped France, with supporters regularly gathering around the Avignon courthouse to support Gisèle Pelicot, who famously waived anonymity to give a voice to survivors and change the public discourse on sexual violence. She told the court during the trial, quote, "It's not for us to feel shame. It's for them." She also insisted videos of her rapes be shown in court as part of the trial. Gisèle Pelicot spoke after the verdict was pronounced.
Je pense enfin aux victimes non reconnues. I'm thinking about the victims who aren't recognized and whose stories often remain in the shadows. I want you to know we share the same struggle. I wish to express my deepest gratitude to all those who've supported me throughout this ordeal. Your testimonies devastated me, and I was able to pull the strength from them to come back every day to face these long days of the trial.
Gisele Pellico is 72 years old. The charges of rape and the acts engaged in by the men go back over the last decade. The U.S. government will pay a record nearly $116 million to settle lawsuits brought by 103 women who survived sexual abuse and assault at the now-shuttered Federal Correctional Institution in Dublin, California. The prison became known as the Rape Club due to the systematic assaults perpetrated by staff on prisoners. We'll have more on the story later in the broadcast and hear from one of the survivors and plaintiffs in the case. In Texas, a Houston father is fighting to reunite his family after Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, deported his wife and four children to Mexico last week. Two of the children, infant twins, are U.S. citizens born in September. The father, Federico Arellano Jr., is also a U.S. citizen. The mother, Christina Salazar, and the couple's four children were apparently lured by ICE to a meeting point where they were arrested and forced into a plane to Reynosa, Mexico. They were targeted for deportation after Salazar and their older children missed an immigration hearing because she was recovering from her emergency cesarean section, which the family had notified the court of. This comes as President-elect Trump has repeatedly vowed to end birthright citizenship. Another employee of President Biden's State Department has resigned over U.S. policy towards Gaza. Mike Casey quietly left his role as deputy political counselor on Gaza, one of only two jobs specifically focused on Gaza, in July, after realizing all his reports were systematically dismissed despite the rapidly mounting death toll and catastrophic humanitarian situation in Gaza. Casey found that, unlike in his previous diplomatic work in Malaysia, China and Pakistan, the U.S. government does not expect Israeli authorities to listen to any of their recommendations or demands and instead defers completely to Israel. Mike Casey told The Guardian in an interview about his resignation, he, quote, got so tired of writing about dead kids and that, quote, we don't have a policy on Palestine. We just do what the Israelis want us to do, he said. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to rule on the constitutionality of a contested TikTok ban. Under the law passed by a bipartisan Congress, the highly popular social media platform would become banned unless its Chinese owner, ByteDance, sells the app to an American company by January 19th. Critics have described the ban as a form of censorship fueled by anti-Chinese sentiment. The state of Indiana has carried out its first execution in 15 years, killing 49-year-old Joseph Corcoran by lethal injection after a 27-year legal battle to spare his life. Corcoran had been convicted of killing his brother and three other men, including his sister's fiancé, in 1997. Corcoran's lawyers say his execution was unconstitutional since he suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. Corcoran's sister fought for the execution to be halted, saying she had forgiven him and that, quote, I believe that the death penalty does not address grief or provide true justice, especially for victims and those with mental illness. Instead, it's a lengthy, costly, and political process, she said. And thousands of Amazon workers have launched the largest strike against the retail giant in U.S. history, setting up picket lines at hundreds of Amazon fulfillment centers nationwide. Workers say Amazon forced them to strike by refusing to follow the law and bargain with the thousands of Amazon workers who organize with the Teamsters Union. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. And I'm here with Nermeen Sheikh, but first, we're going to go to break.
Who am I? A student, observing my environment to see contradictions in concrete conditions. Evidence we're living in an obsolete system. Poverty-stricken folks constantly living hope. American dreams dangling from a rope by God, folks. Working in the public school sector, who lose one youth to death per semester? I guess the cost of living is going up while the chance of living is going down. What the f*** is the basis? I'm saying never no more.
the solution for the poor, recruit them for the war. They kicked in the door, waving the 4-5 cal. 1 million died, I survived, now alive I reside, where the struggle and the hustle coincide. In this moment in time, a shift in the tide. Get the blindfold lifted from your eyes and see what we see and stop pretending it's alright, man. My wounded eyes seen through the lies, many soon to die. Who am I? A student, I study to survive. Wounded eyes seen through the lies, many soon to die. Who am I? A student, I study to survive. Wounded eyes seen through the lies, many brutalized. So we rise and we fight for the future, we strive. Wounded eyes seen through the lies, many soon to die. Who am I? Who am I, y'all?
Sending this one out.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We turn now to a grim reality that Syrians are facing after the toppling of the Assad regime, the discovery of mass graves across the country. According to the International Commission on Missing Persons, more than 150,000 Syrians remain unaccounted for after being held in Assad's prisons. Many are believed to be buried in mass graves. The Syrian search and rescue group, White Helmets, has received reports of at least 13 mass grave sites across the country, 8 of them near Damascus. Human Rights Watch visited the site of one mass grave, also a mass execution site, in the Tadumun neighborhood of Damascus last week. The group was able to confirm the exact location of the grave after verifying and geolocating a previously leaked video from April 2013.
The video shows Syrian government forces and pro-government militia shooting 11 men in civilian clothing, blindfolded and bound. The victims' bodies then fall into a pit. One of three perpetrators films while the other two men carry out the executions, taunting and laughing at victims as they die. Since the fall of the Assad government, we have been able to travel to Damascus to see the area for ourselves. We know the grave was a machine-dug pit between two buildings. It measured approximately 3 meters wide, 7 meters long, and 2 meters deep. In the footage, 13 bodies are visible in the pit. During the course of the 6-minute, 43-second video, the gunmen kill 11 more. In visiting the grave here, we also discovered today the presence of human remains in and around the site. Local residents told us that access to the square kilometers surrounding this mass grave was restricted by Syrian authorities for a long time. One resident told us that pro-government forces ordered him to bury bodies some years after the executions. It's unclear to what extent human remains in the area have been removed since 2013.
That video from Human Rights Watch. We're joined now from Amman, Jordan, by Heba Zayadeen, senior Middle East and North Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. She's just returned from a week in Damascus. Heba, thank you so much for being with us. Tell us what you found. Heba, if you can hear us, tell us what you found. Heba, can you hear us? Okay, we're going to go to another break, and we're going to link up our audio connection as quickly as we can.
Je me...
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're having some international audio connection issues, so we're going to be going to the Human Rights Watch report on Gaza, as well as on mass graves in Syria a little later in the broadcast. But we're going to look right now at what's happening here at home in California.
The U.S. government has agreed to pay nearly $116 million to settle lawsuits brought by 103 women who survived sexual abuse and assault at a federal prison in Dublin, California, which was shuttered earlier this year. The facility, FCI Dublin, became known as the Rape Club due to rampant sexual abuse by prison staff, including the former warden who's now in jail after being convicted of sexually abusing women at the prison. The Los Angeles Times reports $116 million is the largest amount ever paid by the federal government for misconduct at a federal prison.
We're joined now by two guests. Courtney Hansen is a community organizer with the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, which helped launch the Dublin Prison Solidarity Coalition to advocate alongside survivors for systemic changes inside prisons. Aimee Chavira was formerly incarcerated at FCI Dublin and is part of the class action sexual abuse lawsuit against the Federal Bureau of Prisons. We're going to go first to Courtney. Courtney Hansen, explain the background of this case.
Well, as you said, this current monetary settlement is the largest aggregate settlement in BOP history. And we are seeing this type of legal victory because of the courage of survivors who are incarcerated at FCI Dublin. And our organization, the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, started going into Dublin in 2022 with extremely dedicated attorneys to hear these survivors who were speaking out and build power and solidarity with them across the walls.
And Aimee, if you could respond to this decision by the federal government to pay $116 million to women. You yourself were in prison there.
Yes. Hi, good morning. What do I think? I think this is a victory. I think this shows that everything that has been going on in there was, and it is true, and it's still going on. It doesn't change anything. Money, no amount of money will change what was done to us and what continues to happen.
Aimee, can you explain what did happen? Tell us over these last years what took place and when you were imprisoned there in the Dublin Federal Prison.
Sexual abuse, rape, assault, verbal abuse, retaliation. Behind these federal walls, people don't understand and can't imagine the severity of this problem. We were sentenced to go to prison and pay for our crime, which is no problem. But that wasn't happening. We were paying for our crime and being assaulted, sexually assaulted, mistreated, retaliated on. It went from locking us in our room. I was locked in my room and asked for me to conduct sexual activities or things. I was retaliated, sent by the warden who is now in prison, as I complained. There's a lot of, once you start complaining behind, you know, when you're in prison, the retaliation starts. It's not easy. It's not fun. It's not funny. These are real things that are going on in these prisons, not just Dublin. FCI Dublin went through this. This is across the board. These are all prisons. I'm sorry if I get a little bit emotional. The retaliation went from once you complain to the warden. I myself complained to the warden on one morning. That same morning, he sent Officer Ramos, who is no longer alive, he took his own life, with another officer, Officer DeLuca. They restrict searched three inmates in my cell, then took me to, which is called R&D, to when you get to prison and, you know, you got to go through this process. And I was taken there to get strip searched, to later on being asked, and demanded that it was a direct order for me to strip, hand my clothes over, and use my fingers, my hand, to go across my private part. Not one, not two, a couple, you know, more than a couple of times. Is this right? Is this what? I don't think my judge sends me to go through this. These are heinous crimes. The punishment that I believe they should get is more than what we have gotten. We have gotten very far, and I'm very grateful. I have joy, but we still have a long journey ahead of us to keep fighting for, you know, for these officers in uniform to be held accountable.
I mean, I just want to say how brave you are, what a woman of courage you are to be willing to speak out about what happened to you. And of course, what this has led to is this more than $100 million settlement. And I'm wondering, Courtney, if you can explain how this was organized. This in no way takes away this pain and suffering from the women in the prison, but how this settlement came about.
Well, I just want to say also it has been truly the honor of a lifetime to organize alongside courageous survivors like Aimé. And this was truly a robust, collective, grassroots effort that could not have happened, first of all, without survivors organizing amongst themselves, and then dedicated movement attorneys, those at Rights Behind Bars and the California Collaborative for Immigrant Justice, and then our organization, also with an inside-outside model, going in and bringing the information and the stories and the demands out. And it's also important to note that this monetary win comes on the heels of another massive legal victory earlier this month in a separate but related class action lawsuit in which our organization was a lead plaintiff alongside individual survivors. And this is a lawsuit that is demanding, and it looks like winning through a proposed settlement agreement and consent decree, policy changes. We need policy changes to ensure that this type of staff sexual abuse stops happening. And like Aimé said, it's still happening all across BOP facilities in this country where Dublin survivors are still being held by their abusers.
So Aimé, just to go back to you, I mean, we're very, very sorry for these this horrific violence that you endured in this prison. I just want to ask, were you aware at the time that there were so many other women who were being subjected to sexual violence as well at the same time as you were?
Yes, Aimé, and it's very important for people to know that it's hard to communicate with each other because it causes shame, you know, you're ashamed. It's embarrassing. But we all knew about each other. And it's hard. It was hard then to speak with one another of the stuff that was going on, of us being seen, being showered, you know, them opening our curtains as we're in the shower, as we're changing, and, you know, we're not dressed. So many women in there that I know and that we now are able to talk about and say, I'm so sorry, I knew what was going on and we didn't talk about it then. This was not, I mean, and this is just 103 women. We're talking about this prison held a lot of more prisoners, a lot of more inmates at this time. So it was their culture that these officers created there. This was their small world of them abusing us, and it happened every time, every day. You know, you look to your left and something was going on to someone else. You look to your right and some, you know, there's another inmate, you know, being locked in their room. This is a huge problem. This is not just a culture at Dublin. This is happening in other prisons across the board. And it's important for people to know that we need to stop. We need to stop this abuse that we're going through.
And now this settlement means, Aimé, that you and the other women will receive on average $1.1 million, each of you?
No. I think that, you know, it's going to go evenly. it that's not the way it's going to happen. There is a judge, you know, I'm not a special, answer this for you, but it's not even across the board. No.
Well, I'm H. Oviedo. We want to say thank you so much for being with us and being willing to share your story. Formerly incarcerated at FCI Dublin, the federal prison in California, part of the class action sexual abuse lawsuit against the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And Courtney Hansen, community organizer with the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, which helped launch the Dublin Prison Solidarity Coalition. Last question to Courtney. Courtney, are there other prisons that where you're going through the same kind of negotiation and could lead to settlements like this?
Our current proposed consent decree in our class action lawsuit, which was demanding injunctive relief and policy changes on behalf of everybody, like I may said, who was impacted by the culture of violence at Dublin. If that consent decree gets approved by the judge, it will apply to over 12 BOP facilities across the country where Dublin survivors are currently held. And this is just the beginning. This is not the end. We will continue through grassroots advocacy, perhaps future legal action if necessary, to figure out how to ensure that this never happens again. And we need to note that Biden, President Biden, with a stroke of his pen, could ensure that these Dublin survivors come home for the holidays where they belong, where they could heal with their families in safety.
Courtney Hansen, thank you so much. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
In a major new report, Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of committing acts of extermination and genocide by deliberately restricting safe water for drinking and sanitation to the Gaza Strip. Tirana Hassan, the executive director at Human Rights Watch, said, quote, "This isn't just negligence. It's a calculated policy of deprivation that's led to the deaths of thousands from dehydration and disease. That's nothing short of the crime against humanity of extermination and an act of genocide," she said. The report details how Israel has cut off water and blocked fuel, food, and humanitarian aid from entering the Gaza Strip. In addition, Human Rights Watch accused Israel of deliberately destroying and damaging water and sanitation infrastructure, as well as water repair materials. Israel has rejected the Human Rights Watch findings, saying, quote, "The truth is the complete opposite of HRW's lies." But just in the past day, the United Nations said Israel had once again denied requests to deliver aid to Palestinians in Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia, and Jabalia, areas that have been under Israeli siege for months.
We go right now to Bill Van Esveld, acting Israel and Palestine Associate Director at Human Rights Watch. He helped edit the Human Rights Watch report just out today, titled "Extermination and Acts of Genocide, Israel Deliberately Depriving Palestinians in Gaza of Water." He's joining us from Athens, Greece. Bill, thanks so much for being with us. Why don't you lay out your findings?
Thank you very much for having me on this issue. I think this report lays out a clear state policy of depriving people in Gaza of water. So we looked at four different ways in which all access has been controlled and restricted. First, there are the water pipelines that come from Israel to Gaza. They supply only about 20% of the water in Gaza, but about 50% of the drinking water, because Gaza's aquifer underground has been completely contaminated over years and years of closure. So the first thing was cutting off those water pipes. The second thing was there are water resources inside Gaza, so those were cut off too. Those are desalination plants, those are water pumps going to the aquifer, those are water sanitation facilities, water treatment facilities. They all need energy. They need electricity, they need fuel. Israel cut off electricity and fuel within the first few days of the war, but that wasn't enough. Four of those six water treatment plants I was talking about in Gaza had solar panel fields that were their source of electricity in case electricity got cut off, because electricity has been terrible in Gaza for many years as a result of the siege. It wasn't enough for Israel to cut off the electricity coming from outside. They also sent in military bulldozers to systematically destroy every one of the solar panels in those solar fields, rendering those sanitation facilities completely offline. And two more issues. One is, you know, the infrastructure of water in Gaza has been so destroyed and damaged by the hostilities that it needs urgent repair. There was a major warehouse inside Gaza with a lot of spare parts. It was bombed, and the Palestinian staff who were there with their families, some of them were killed in that bombing. Finally, humanitarian agencies such as Oxfam, UNICEF, and others have been trying since the war started to get water and sanitation materials imported into Gaza to help purify water, chlorine tablets, all sorts of things to fix the network. Those were systematically blocked. Even at moments when the Israeli military was allowing other civilian items into Gaza, we were told those were blocked. That is a complete state policy of denial of access to water, and the results are horrifying.
So, Bill, just to convey, you begin the report by citing World Health Organization figures about the amount of water, minimum amount of water that's required per person per day to sustain a life. What the WHO recommends is 247 liters per person per day. And since October 7th, 2023, people in Gaza, an individual in Gaza, has access to 2 to 9 liters per day, as against the 247 that the WHO recommends. So if you could say, Bill, on the basis of the people that you spoke to, that, that Human Rights Watch spoke to, what has the impact of this been on people in Gaza? What did medical personnel that you spoke to say? And also in terms of excess deaths, we hear, of course, of this horrific figure of 45,000 people who've been killed by direct attacks by the Israeli military. But how many more deaths are likely the result of water deprivation?
Thank you. Yeah, that's right. So in Israel, the average consumption per day is 247 liters per person per day of water. The minimum, absolute minimum required for life, even in an emergency situation, is 15 liters a day. And people in Gaza have been getting 2 to 9 liters a day on average. Now, that's an average that, in, you know, I should say in northern Gaza, for example, for 5 months, people got 0 liters of drinkable water per day. The effects are as horrifying as you might expect. We spoke to 115 or more people, people in Gaza, healthcare providers. And, you know, the lack of water kills you in a million different ways. There are babies who have died directly from dehydration, but there's also people who are dying from disease and contracting terrible illness. I mean, you cannot bathe if you have no water, and 250,000 people, at least in Gaza, now have skin disease as a result. I mean, 1 5-minute shower is more water than people in Gaza get in an entire week. We spoke to surgeons who said that wounds are not healing because the bodies of the patients are so dehydrated. Kids were coming in dying in the hospital because they were drinking from contaminated water sources. Now, if you add to this the decimation of the healthcare sector in Gaza, that means that people are coming in with waterborne diseases that can no longer be treated. So children dying at large numbers of hepatitis A, which normally would have a death rate, but very, very small, that has ballooned horrifyingly in Gaza. If you add all of these things up, there is a huge hidden death toll. We know that 45,000 names have been collected by the Gaza Ministry of Health, but those are almost all people who were killed directly by explosive weapons or shot directly during the course of the hostilities. That doesn't include the hidden death toll of people dying from dehydration, starvation, disease, and illness. Now, there were 99 healthcare professionals who wrote a letter to President Biden and his administration in October, and they calculated on the basis of the International Committee that tracks famine and that has sort of global standards for the numbers of deaths expected, that based on the assessment of starvation and hunger and lack of water in Gaza, at least 62,000 more people may be dead in Gaza. That is, you know, we say thousands in the report. It could easily be tens of thousands or more. We are talking talking about a mass death situation that is the result of deliberate policy.
I want to go, Bill, to one of the many comments by Israeli officials quoted in your report to determine Israel's genocidal intent in Gaza. This is the former defense minister, Yoav Gallant, speaking just days after the October 7th, 2023 attacks.
I have ordered a complete siege on the Gaza Strip. There will be no electricity, no food, no fuel. Everything is closed. We are fighting human animals, and we will act accordingly.
Talk, Bill Van Asfeld, about the significance of what he said here. Again, Yoav Gallant, at the time the defense minister of Israel. And actually recently, the ICAC has issued arrest warrants for him and Netanyahu. And even with those arrest warrants issued, the International Criminal Court, he just recently went to Washington, D.C. to meet with officials.
Yes, the same Yoav Gallant, an indicted war criminal by the International Criminal Court, was just meeting with the U.S. Defense Secretary and, you know, President Biden's senior Middle East advisor. It's really, really shocking. This is the same man who once said when the United States was going to sanction an Israeli military unit, we don't listen to the United States. No one will teach us about morality. Really disappointing move by the Biden administration there and others who met with him. What that statement of his and statements by other senior Israeli leaders in positions of control and command in the Israeli army and over this issue of denial of access to water. Their statements are evidence of an intent, and they were also carried out by the military and, you know, by the authorities. So it's not just they said something and it sounds bad. No, what they said was actually what they did. That's extremely serious, and that is part of what led us to the conclusion of extermination. That is a crime against humanity of deliberately causing mass death, and one of the ways that it's, you know, that can be committed is by depriving people of what they need to stay alive, such as water. That same crime, which we define and conclude is the crime of extermination, is the same act as one of the acts of genocide listed in the Genocide Convention and indeed in the International Criminal Court statute on its article on genocide, deliberately inflicting conditions of life on people calculated to bring about the destruction of that group. Now, what Gallant said there could be evidence of genocidal intent. Genocide is an extraordinarily difficult crime to prove because the intent must be, according to international law, that you are not just killing people in large numbers, which is extermination, but that you are killing them specifically because you want to destroy the group they are part of. And if you look at the evidence of Israeli military and government actions on water and state like that one on water, we think you may have evidence already of genocidal intent.
So can I ask you, Bill Van Asfeld, is this the first time the Human Rights Watch is accusing Israel of genocide in Gaza?
This is the first time that we've made a finding of genocidal acts in Gaza. It is not an accusation that we level lightly. We have not done this very often in our history. We accused the Myanmar military of genocidal acts against the Rohingya in 2017, and we found full-blown genocide against the Kurds in Saddam Hussein's Anfal campaign in Iraq in the 80s, in the 90s, and we found genocide against also in Rwanda in the 80s. An extremely difficult crime to prove. Mass killing deliberately to destroy people because they're part of that group. Not something we level lightly, but yes, we found it here.
Bill Van Asfeld, we thank you so much for being with us. Acting Israel and Palestine Associate Director at Human Rights Watch. He helped edit the Human Rights Watch report just out today, titled Extermination and Acts of Genocide. Israel deliberately depriving Palestinians in Gaza of water. We'll link to that report at democracynow.org. Bill Van Asfeld joining us from Athens, Greece. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show looking at Syria and the discovery of mass graves across the country after the toppling of the Assad regime. According to the International Commission on Missing Persons, more than 150,000 Syrians remain unaccounted for after being held in Assad's prisons. Many are believed to be buried in mass graves. We're joined now from Amman, Jordan, by Hiba Zayadin, senior Middle East and North Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. She just returned from a week in Damascus. Hiba, welcome to Democracy Now. If you could just begin by talking about what you learned from your time in Damascus and what you saw.
Absolutely, and thank you for having me on the show. So upon arriving in Damascus, one of the first sites that we decided to visit was that of the heinous 2013 Tadamun massacre, which a video of had leaked in 2021. We had been investigating this crime for a long time now. We had confirmed the exact location of the mass grave and decided to go confirm it for ourselves. But what we found there, you know, we were not prepared for what we had found. We were not prepared for what we were going to see, even though we knew from conversations with residents earlier in 2021 that it was the likely site of other summary killings as well. But when we arrived, what we saw was scores of human remains, of fingers, of a part of a skull, pelvic bones strewn across the surrounding neighborhood. We saw families, families had brought to us bags that they had collected of bones from the rubble in dilapidated stores in the area. We saw children toying with these bones. It was not anything that we had expected, to see. And we spoke to more residents and found out, you know, that this was the site of so much more horror than we had expected. I had spoken to a resident who was forced at the age of 15, this was back in 2016, to dig graves and to dump bodies, corpses, into those graves. We had found, we had spoken to an ambulance driver who was tasked to retrieve bodies from that area in 2018 and 2019. I spoke to countless families who had missing loved ones that they did not know what had happened to and had no answers for. And so, you know, it was really important that we highlight how imperative it is to protect and to secure this site and many others like it. There are mass graves across Syria, and this was just one of them. And we had visited others as well. We had seen desperate families visiting these sites, sometimes taking matters into their own hands, digging the graves on their own, trying to find anything about this. We saw them at the morgue where there were several unidentified bodies, families, you know, clutching pictures of their loved ones, pushing it into the camera to try and show it to the world, to try and get any sort of information. We also visited, you know, some of the most notorious detention facilities that we had for a long time worked on and documented abuses and torture in. What we found there too was quite upsetting, in that there was intentional destruction of documents, of evidence. There was looting. There was total insecurity for the first couple of days that we were there, with people coming in, retrieving files, leaving with them, tampering with the evidence. And we know, you know, that the Assad government operated a chilling bureaucratic system whereby they documented every crime. They documented it in detail. And that evidence had existed in these detention facilities, in the military courts, in the prisons themselves. And every minute that passes where there is inaction, where these documents, these sites are not being preserved and not being secured, is just one more family possibly never knowing what happened to their loved ones. And it also means that there are officials who had perpetrated some of the most horrific atrocities over the past decade that will go free and that will not be brought to justice because of just how quickly a lot of this evidence is disappearing.
Well, I'd like to read from a Financial Times article headlined "The Syrian Neighborhood at the Heart of Assad's Killing Machine," which is the neighborhood that you've just spoken about, Tadamun. The article begins saying, quote, "In Tadamun, the children know the difference between a human jaw and a dog's. So inured are they to decomposing remains, a consequence of living in the desolate Damascus suburb, that the boys casually toss around skulls and fractured femurs." So, Hiba, if you could speak, you just talked about the importance of protecting these sites. I mean, many have said that Assad's regime has just fallen and this work is only just beginning, the work of excavating these mass graves. Are there concerns that these sites will not be protected? And if not, where will the who will damage them? How will they somehow be disrupted?
Definitely there are concerns right now. I mean, we have seen that for transitional authorities, this has not been a top priority. And our presence in Damascus was to call for the preservation of this evidence, was to make it clear to transitional authorities that this must be a priority and that it is of the utmost urgency, because now is the time. Yesterday was the time. A week ago was the time to be protecting these sites. And as I had said earlier, every day that passes, we're losing more valuable information. And, you know, it is a priority, or it should be a priority to transitional authorities, not just because of justice and accountability efforts, but also because you have thousands upon thousands of families who are seeking answers, who deserve answers, and who have no idea what the transitional authorities are doing about this right now. They need to be raising awareness about what it means to tamper with this evidence, what it means to retrieve documents from an area without, you know, preserving the chain of custody. Because, you know, once you take these documents out without documenting exactly who and how and from where they were taken, none of this is going to stand in court. And this is what we've been impressing upon transitional authorities. This is what we've been calling for UN bodies, relevant bodies, to arrive at the scene as soon and as urgently as possible. We've been calling on international rescue teams to also arrive on site, and for Syrian groups to really be at the forefront of this massive, massive effort.
This is State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller speaking earlier this week.
When you look at the evidence that is coming out of Syria in the now 10 days since the Assad regime fell, it continues to shock the conscience. And I'm referring not just to the mass graves that have been uncovered, but information that we have been gathering inside the United States government, including information that's not yet publicly known.
Can you respond, Heba, to these remarks? In particular, Matt Miller suggesting more will be revealed about abuses by the Assad regime.
So, I mean, absolutely more will be revealed. And I think, you know, there have been documents in detention facilities that remain intact. And there is movement. You know, we have seen a bit more of a stepping up in the security of some of these detention facilities. But there is no coordinated effort right now to preserve these documents. And it is really important to stress that these documents belong to the Syrian people. This evidence belongs to the Syrian people, and they need to be at the forefront of these efforts to preserve and secure, obviously with the help of UN relevant bodies, obviously with the help of international actors. But these documents belong to the Syrian people. The evidence belongs to them and needs to remain with them and in their hands. And that's what I would stress in response to some of these remarks.
Heba, what is Human Rights Watch looking out for when Israel intensifies the attacks on Syria, expanding its occupation of the Golan Heights? You've said that Israel bombed the only facility in Syria that had DNA equipment that would allow for the identification of remains in these mass graves. Can you explain?
Yes, so I mean, Israel's strikes in Syria come on the heels of its brutal military campaigns in Lebanon and in Gaza, where we've documented war crimes, crimes against humanity, and as we were, you know, my colleague has just been saying on your show, acts of genocide in Gaza specifically. You know, Syria is right now in a very fragile state, and the Israeli strikes have almost completely decimated its defense capabilities, but also this has had repercussions and consequences for the issue that we're speaking of right now, the preservation of evidence. Some of these strikes have hit vital facilities, including, you know, the Air Force Intelligence Branch, you know, the institute where these DNA machines were being housed. Other security branches, military security branches that contain vital evidence. And so these strikes are also adding to the quite, you know, upsetting situation that we currently find ourselves in terms of just preserving evidence, making sure that someday, you know, hopefully every family can learn what, you know, what the fate of their loved ones had been and where they may have been buried, and to really be able to give them a decent burial.
Heba Zayadeen, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Senior Middle East and North Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. She's just returned from Syria. That does it for our show. You can watch our show on podcast, video, and audio. See our transcripts at democracynow.org and get our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Anjali Comet, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Beck Castelli, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Uzbek. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st. Help us raise $25,000 to support our local arts and artists and keep our community informed with local news, concerts, and events listings on air and on our website. Visit CFRC.ca today and make your gift to Kingston's longest-running broadcaster serving our community since 1922. Get a tax receipt via Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. For every $5 donated, you get one more chance to win. Thank you for your support.
When I say beat, you say banter. Beat.
Banter.
Beat.
Banter.
When I say beat.